For a moment I meant to suggest otherwise. No, no. The lack of propriety would originate with Figgy. I am fond of my stepdaughter, she said in a rueful voice. But it has been difficult to be a true mother to her. She has resisted my efforts. She does not confide in me. Perhaps if she were a little more at liberty, I suggested. But how can one give liberty to a child so ill-equipped for it? She asked gently. She is clever, like the wards, but in temperament she is not like her mother. The first Lady Tiverton was a scholar, very lively and merry, but serious about her interests. As Figgy has matured, I have begun to worry about her. She has demonstrated a certain wildness of temper, an intractable will of her own. It tasks her father greatly, she confided. We do not know exactly what to do with her. If it tasked her father, he had only himself to blame, I reflected. Figgy was nothing less than his spitting image in this regard. Have you considered educating her? I asked. She is not unintelligent. Perhaps she just needs a bit of schooling to get her out of the habit of being useless. Her eyes took on a shuttered expression. She longs to go to school, but my husband cannot bear to be parted from her. He is a devoted father, she said with a touch of defensiveness. I am certain of it, I told her, but perhaps for her own good he might be persuaded to let her go. She spread her hands. I am sometimes at a loss, I do not mind telling you. He does not discipline her as he ought, and I cannot. A stepmother must naturally tread softly. I think, I said slowly, that Figgy will make her own way in the end. Lady Tiverton roused herself. I must beg your pardon, Miss Speedwell. What must you think of me, prattling on about our family troubles in such a fashion? Before I could make a suitable response, Sir Leicester mounted the dais in front of the curtains, screening the sarcophagus of the Princess Ankerset.
Pray silence, friends, he called.
The dull roar of the assembled crowd fell to a muted buzz. Sir Leicester went on.
I am no great maker of speeches, he began, but I must welcome you all here to Karnak Hall upon this grand occasion.
He went on to talk about the expedition, glossing over the difficulties and heaping praise upon the members of his team. He recounted the thrill of discovering the cave for the first time, the slender crevice in the rock which was to answer the hopes of a lifetime for him. He spoke briefly of Jonas Fowler, the late expedition director, and not at all of John de Morgan. Instead, he lifted his glass and said, in ringing tones,
"She has lain in silence and in dignity for millennia, but tonight I give you, with all her treasures, the Princess Ankerset."
The crowd responded, glasses lifted high. Princess Ankerset. Lady Tiverton went to her husband then, to share in receiving the accolades of the guests, while I drifted off. Stoker was nowhere to be found, doubtless following a trail of his own, and I allowed myself to be caught up in admiration of the finds. I was particularly taken with a set of sandals made of beaten gold, thin as a sheet of paper. Grouped with them was a set of 20 hollow golden pieces, shaped like thimbles but much longer, and clearly meant to cover the ends of the fingers and toes.
"They look devilishly uncomfortable, don't you think?" asked a young woman who appeared at my side.
Instantly, I recognized her as the person who had been in close conversation with Inspector Mornaday upon our arrival.
unlike the other ladies who had come in their finest evening gowns, wearing jewels to rival the princesses. This lady was quietly dressed in a sober gown of dark blue. Her hair was reddish, and coiled in a heavy, serviceable knot at the nape of her neck. A governess, or companion attached to one of the more illustrious guests? I should think them uncomfortable in the extreme, I agreed.
Well, perhaps it is worth it to suffer a little to be a princess.
She peered into the case for a moment, then slanted me a curious look.
I find it odd that Sir Leicester did not mention the mummy's curse with regard to the death of Jonas Fowler, don't you? Nor the disappearance of John de Morgan.
I shrugged. No doubt he wished the attention to be fixed on the success of the expedition, not sensationalist superstition.
I should think misplacing a staff photographer and a priceless diadem would be something more than a superstition. And to lose the expedition director in such a dramatic fashion...
She let her voice trail off suggestively, cocking her head to scrutinize the coronet on my head.
Half the women here are wearing Egyptian jewelry, but I rather think yours is something special.
She said, giving me a narrow look as she extracted a slender notebook and pencil from her pocket.
Would you care to make a statement for the press?
My mind whipped back to the shadowy pavement outside Bishop's Folly.
You. You were the woman who followed us,
I hissed. She grinned broadly and thrust out her hand.
I do not believe we have met. J.J. Butterworth. I said, would you care to make a statement, Miss Speedwell?
I ignored the hand. I most certainly would not. Does Sir Leicester know that you are here? She tipped her head.
Not precisely. He issued an invitation to my newspaper and it happened to fall into my hands.
You mean you stole it? She shrugged one slim shoulder.
A woman must make her own opportunities in this world, don't you agree?
If I did, would I find it in print? She laughed outright.
I think, under other circumstances, Miss Speedwell, we might be friends.
I should sooner befriend a barracuda, I told her evenly. And let us be perfectly clear with one another. I despise you and the dirty little fictions you concoct, and if you print one word about Revelstoke Templeton Vane that is not true... She held up a hand.
I know. You will sue me for libel.
My dear Miss Butterworth, there will be nothing left to sue when I have finished with you. To her credit, she was still smiling when she walked away, head held high. I stood for a moment, staring after her and seething at Mornaday's duplicity. Having seen them together outside, I had little doubt he was the one feeding information to her like a mother bird, dropping tasty morsels into the waiting beak of a chick. At least I could remove any suspicion from Figgy on that score, I thought darkly. I spotted Stoker in the crowd and wove a circuitous path towards him, eager to get him away before Miss Butterworth noticed him. Suddenly a voice, distinctly American, rang out through the hall.
Well, goodness me, but isn't this a sight?
All eyes turned to the doorway, where Horace Steele stood, hands on hips, surveying the room. His son, Henry, stood awkwardly behind him, as dishevelled in his evening suit as he had been in his more casual clothes. Sir Leicester broke from a group of guests, striding towards his former partner as a hush fell over the assembly. Henry, looking distinctly miserable, slipped to the edge of the displays, nearly flattening himself behind a potted palm in his desire to be invisible. I sympathized with him. His father had the heightened colour and bright-eyed mischief of a seasoned provocateur, and Sir Leicester was not the sort of man to back down from a fight. He approached Horace Steele as a bull will charge a red flag, not surprising, considering their last encounter had ended in threats of violence from a distinctly enraged Steele.
"What do you mean in coming here?"
Sir Leicester demanded. Mr. Steele touched the band of black crepe pinned to his arm.
"I came to offer my condolences,"
he said with a touch of reproof.
"I worked with Jonas many a year, and it seemed only fitting to pay tribute to his last expedition."
Sir Leicester purpled a little.
"Oh, of course, of course. Rotten business." "Indeed."
They stood. Sir Leicester squared off, as if to prevent Mr. Steele from entering further. Mr. Steele indicated the displays.
"I see you are still going ahead with the exhibition."
"Naturally,"
Sir Leicester said, puffing out his chest.
"It is what Fowler would have wanted."
"He would at that,"
Mr. Steele agreed. His tactic of aggressive agreeability seemed to have thrown Sir Leicester off his stride. With nothing but perfect politeness and gentility from the American, the Baronet could not very well throw a scene without appearing churlish. They seemed to be at an impasse until Mr. Steele noticed Lady Tiverton and bowed.
"My lady,"
he said, with a courtly gesture. Her eyes were enormous, wide and unblinking.
"Mr. Steele, this is unexpected," she said, her normally low voice even softer than usual.
Mr. Steele smiled thinly.
"As was Jonas Fowler's sad demise."
"Hardly. The fellow had a heart condition, as you well remember,"
Sir Leicester added sharply.
"Certainly. Why, I remember one time he took a fright at a jackal roaming too close to the camp. It howled so loudly you'd have thought it was carrying off a human soul. Poor old Jonas turned white as a sheet and collapsed. But I expected he'd have years left in him."
"Years,"
he said, stressing the word.
"Still, not much a man can do against a mummy's curse, is there?"
It was masterfully done. The Tibetans could speak publicly neither for nor against the curse. They might privately deplore it, but the story was driving sales, and Sir Leicester gave every impression of a shrewd businessman who would press every advantage. He pressed his lips together as Mr. Steele went on.
"Yes, that curse is a curious thing. From the mummy of Princess Ankeset, you say?"
"Yes. She was left in a cave in a remote wadi with some of her grave goods,"
said Patrick Fairbrother as he approached.
"You can see her cartouche for yourself,"
he added, throwing back the curtain in front of the sarcophagus with a flourish. Taking this as an invitation, Mr. Steele stepped neatly around Sir Leicester. He peered at the sarcophagus, stroking his moustaches thoughtfully.
"Very interesting,"
he said quietly.
"So, this is your princess,"
he added, touching the scorched and gilded wood with a fingertip. Sir Leicester hurried to put himself between Horace Steele and his beloved princess.
"It is. She is not to be disturbed."
"I shouldn't dream of it,"
Steele said, giving Sir Leicester a long, speculative glance. Something in that glance angered him, for the Baronet curled his hands into fists.
"This exhibition will be the making of the Tiverton name. It will go down in the annals of Egyptology, and you will be nothing more than a footnote,"
he said, through clenched teeth. Lady Tiverton started, her hand to her throat, but Mr. Steele merely smiled.
"Do not trouble yourself, my lady. I understand your husband very well. Better than anyone, I dare say."
He turned to Sir Leicester.
"Don't fuss. I did not come to make a scene,"
he said, with every appearance of sincerity.
"I simply wanted to see the collection for myself,
and I knew better than to expect a proper invitation since we are not as close as once we were.
The shot hit home, for Sir Leicester flushed, and his hands unknotted themselves.
Of course. Look around, if you must. Have some champagne. I must attend to my guests. The Prince of Wales is expected shortly.
He stalked off, followed by Lady Tiverton. I stood rooted to the spot, hardly feeling Stoker's hand where it gripped my arm.
Steady,
he murmured into my ear.
We can leave now, if you like.
I turned to him, my chest burning with some unnamed emotion. And miss seeing my father? I would not dream of it. Before he could reply, Horace Steele had caught sight of us and made his way over.
Miss Speedwell, Mr. Templeton Vane,
he said, inclining his head.
This is quite the to-do. The collection is fascinating,
Stoker told him,
although I had rather see more art and less in the way of domestic goods.
Mr. Steele waved a hand.
Doesn't much matter, son. If it came out of an Egyptian tomb, it's of interest. I could sell a dirty flower pot if I said it belonged to Amenhotep,
he said absently. His eye had been caught by the diadem.
Why, Miss Speedwell, what have we here?
Just a little something belonging to the Princess Ankeset, I told him. Do you like it? He looked closely, taking in the crown from the animal figures on the top to the incised cartouche about the base. I could smell the bay rum of his shaving lotion, and he was near enough that I could see the precise line of whiskers at the edge of his moustaches. His breath was oddly cool against my cheek, and just as I began to grow very aware of his scrutiny, he stepped back.
Lovely,
was all that he said. He looked around.
I don't suppose there is anything stronger than champagne on offer?
He asked in a hopeful voice. I have aguardiente in a flask, I confessed. He grinned.
Miss Speedwell, you are a woman after my own heart. I have been married 3 times, but I am becoming quite determined to make it 4.
Stoker rolled his eyes at the raillery and hailed a passing waiter.
Can you find a glass of whiskey for Mr. Steele?
The waiter bobbed obediently, and Horace Steele favored Stoker with a smile.
Bless you, son. A man can handle only so much fizz before he floats plumb away.
The waiter reappeared almost instantly, proffering the promised glass. Horace Steele took it with a gallant gesture in my direction.
To your very good health, my dear Miss Speedwell.
At that moment, the hall was plunged into darkness, each gas mantle failing simultaneously as a low, unearthly moan filled the air. There were excited murmurings in the crowd as people speculated that the theatrics were simply part of the evening's entertainment. But it was apparent from the Tivertons' reactions this was not so. Lady Tiverton gasped, and her husband sputtered in the blackness.
By God! Do you know what I've paid for this place? I'll have the proprietor up for fraud, I will. This is intolerable!
A light flared up in the musicians' gallery, a torch held high in the grip of a figure that stepped from the shadows. It was Anubis, the jackal god, dressed much as we had seen him last, with a low linen kilt and a breastplate. We were paralyzed with horror and shock as he stepped to the edge of the gallery, raising his torch towards us. He motioned to Sir Leicester. He said nothing, and it was this silence that was more chilling than any threat could have been. He merely stood, pointing an accusatory finger at the baronet. Then the torch went out, and once more the hall was plunged into blackness. For a long moment it seemed no one moved, But then everything happened at once. Sir Leicester gave a low moan. Lady Tiverton's composure broke on a sob, and I felt a rough hand snatch the diadem from my head. I cried out and thrust my hands in front of me, trying to grab my attacker, but my fingers closed on empty air. Stoker struck a vesta, and the little flame flared to life, illuminating the scene immediately around us. Sir Leicester looked stricken, while Lady Tiverton started towards him, her lips pale with shock. He caught her to him in a desperate embrace, a drowning man clinging to his bulwark. There was no sign of the thief who had wrenched the coronet from me. Patrick Fairbrother looked utterly stunned as he stared blankly in the direction of the gallery. Horace Steele, still clutching his glass of whiskey, had his gaze fixed upon Sir Leicester, his expression inscrutable as Figgy collapsed with a wail into Stoker's arms, just as the vesta sputtered out. I do not know how long we remained in darkness, a few seconds only, although it seemed far longer, but the lights blazed on again, the gas mantles flickering once more to life. Lady Tiverton thrust herself from her husband's embrace. "Figgy!" she cried. Patrick Fairbrother's expression was grim. Sir Leicester took in the sight of Stoker, his arms full of Figgy, and began to bluster.
"Here now, sir!"
"She swooned, Sir Leicester. She wants a burnt feather, or perhaps just a stout slap," I offered, lifting my hand. "Shall I?" At that, Figgy moaned and fluttered her eyes. Grasping my skirts in both hands, I made for the gallery, cursing the delay that Figgy's swoon had caused. I glanced behind me only once to see her clinging to Stoker, no doubt begging him not to endanger himself, but I did not wait to see. It took a moment to find the stairs, concealed behind a bit of panelling in the corridor. They were narrow and dark, and I hurtled up them as quickly as I dared. The gallery, as I had feared, was empty. Stoker joined me a moment later, swivelling his head around as he peered into the shadows.
"Which way?"
he demanded. I spied a bit of panelling not quite flush with the others. "There!" The door was held in place with a flimsy lock, but Stoker put his shoulder to the panel and splintered it with a single thrust. Not waiting for him, I vaulted over the broken remains of the door and into the darkness beyond. Another narrow staircase wound up from the gallery, and in the distance I could just make out the glimmer of a light.
"I hear footsteps!"
I called back to Stoker, not bothering to lower my voice. Anubis, whoever the devil might be, must have heard the commotion when Stoker broke through the door. He would know we were in pursuit. Stoker close behind, I charged up the staircase and into a series of narrow passages, little better than catwalks. Each ended in another staircase that brought us still higher, climbing ever upwards into the eaves of the building. We pushed on, following the dim glow of the lantern bobbing ahead. But Anubis had the advantage of us. He was familiar with the intricate passages, and by locking two more doors on the way, he gained valuable time as we were forced to pause and light vestas as Stoker battered down the narrow panels.
"You would think he'd have deduced that we are not to be stopped," I muttered at the last of the locked doors.
Stoker set his shoulder to it and gave a single brutal lunge, knocking it off its hinges.
"He needn't stop us," he said grimly. "He need only slow us down."
The point was a valid one. No sooner had we burst into the last of the passages than we saw the figure of Anubis at the end of a long corridor, vanishing behind a door. We gave chase, wrenching open the door to find that it concealed a staircase.
"Bollocking hell," Stoker muttered. "He is doubling back and heading downstairs. We ought to have divided our efforts."
"Too late for that now,"
I reminded him as we hurtled down the stairs. This staircase ended in the corridor outside the storerooms, and we emerged into the corridor with no sign of Anubis. Only the door to the alley, still swinging on its hinges, provided a clue. We charged after, shouting for police, but none replied.
"Where the devil are they?"
I demanded.
"On the front pavement, waiting for the bloody prince,"
Stoker replied, as we emerged into the empty alleyway. He swore lavishly as we turned from side to side, looking for any clue as to where Anubis had fled.
"There!"
I cried. Just visible in the shadows was the lid of the sewer, askew. From it a faint light emanated, growing dimmer and dimmer with each second.
"Like a rat," he said grimly.
There was neither time nor inclination for discussion. We lifted off the iron disc and stared down into the stinking underbelly of London. Directly beneath us was a narrow vertical passage, leading to a sort of underground chamber some 12 feet below the street. Stoker looked at me across the fetid hole.
"Ladies first."
I gathered up my satin skirts and dropped into the opening, finding footholds on the slippery rungs of the iron staples set into the brick wall of the passage. When I reached the bottom, I put out one tentative toe. My evening slipper was instantly swallowed by the swirling brown water which flowed ankle-deep beneath the great city above. This was one of the legendary underground rivers of London, paved over earlier in the century to enclose the stinking, open flow of sewage and halt the spread of disease. The water still flowed here, carrying refuse from the furthest reaches of town to Father Thames himself. I suspected the water was deeper than usual, for the melting snows from the storms would have raised the river, and the water gushing past us was cold and fast. I glanced down the length of the chamber and saw a glow at the far end. I signalled up to Stoker and he swung down, skipping 2 or 3 staples at a time until he reached my side.
"We need light," I told him. "Have you your vestas?"
He shook his head.
"Too dangerous. There are pockets of flammable gases down here. A spark could set off an explosion."
"But Anubis," I began.
"Is welcome to take his own chances,"
Stoker said grimly.
"We will navigate by his light and hope if it does blow up it doesn't take us with it."
I pointed to the fading glow. "That way." We made our way to the end of the chamber, unspeakable things floating past our legs as we walked. The odour was beyond belief, a living thing that curled into us, noxious and corrupting. Where Anubis had disappeared, the chamber narrowed to a tunnel, scarcely higher than my head, and Stoker bent double as we entered. Far ahead I detected a gleam of light, and I could hear the flow of fast water. There was the rush of wind, marginally less foul than that of the chamber. We followed the little nimbus of light like a terrible star for a long while, so long that I lost all bearing, all concept of time in that dreadful netherworld. Anubis pushed forwards, no doubt out of desperation, for fear of discovery can drive one to do the incomprehensible. Still we followed, driving him on like hounds upon a fox. The tunnels narrowed in places until I could barely fit through them. I dared not look behind to see how Stoker managed. In other spots, they opened into great stinking chambers, large as a ballroom, with high vaulted ceilings soaring overhead. And everywhere, the endless stench of filth and the bright, knowing eyes of rats watching us from the shadows. Still, Anubis pushed on, and still we followed until we turned down one of the labyrinthine passages after him, and the light went out with the abruptness of a death. One moment we had the fitful consolation of it, glimmering vaguely ahead, and the next it was gone. Bereft of illumination, we were blinded until our eyes adjusted. High above, a grill gave on to the night sky, admitting starlight and a fitful moon. It cast an eerie glow over the aqueous world, nightmarish and bleak. I could make out Stoker's silhouette, a tall black shadow, but nothing more.
"Bastard," he said with feeling.
"Where could he have gone?" I demanded.
"Up and out," Stoker told me flatly. "He must have seized the chance to nip up one of the ladders and let himself out, taking the light with him."
"Then we must do the same," I said. I put a hand out to grasp the lowest of the staples embedded in the wall, but I turned too quickly, or the muck attached to the base of my slipper had grown too thick, for suddenly my feet were swept out from under me, and I was flailing, falling, flat upon my back and caught by the current. I was carried away, borne aloft on that fetid, stinking water.
"Veronica!"
Stoker's voice cut through the impossible, endless night of that forsaken place. "I'm here," I cried. But I could not begin to compute where here was. There was no proper light, no marker by which I could gain my bearings. Only that river carrying me away, as implacable as the Styx. The rush of it filled my ears, and after a moment I was conscious of it growing louder, ever louder, and I realized with horror that I was approaching a sort of confluence. We had seen passages like this already, places where one set of tunnels debouched into another. Sometimes when the tunnels narrowed, it caused a great increase in the velocity of the water. In others, where the tunnels were of differing heights, it caused a sort of hideous waterfall, an unnatural cataract with falls of 30 feet in some places. The closer I was borne, the louder the water pounded, and I knew then where I was bound. I would be carried over the edge of the tunnel, and off one of these precipitous drops into the hell depths below. The fall itself would at least maim. If I were lucky, it would kill me quickly. I reached for purchase on the filth-slimed walls, but my nails scrabbled against the brick, breaking but never catching. My feet could not support me against the onslaught of that water, and I took as deep a breath as I dared, and said one word as I was launched free of the tunnel and out into the open air of the chamber beyond. I waited for the sensation of falling, but it did not come. Instead, there was a moment of phenomenal weightlessness as I floated, light as a butterfly, hovering over a blossom. And then the feeling of a hand, strong as iron, banding about my wrist before the pain rocketed through my arm and my shoulder was wrenched nearly from its socket. My body slammed into the wall below, but I did not fall. I looked up and saw Stoker's face, surrounded by a nimbus of light. "Good God, am I dead? I cannot be, for surely you are no angel," I murmured.
"Anubis left his lantern, you daft woman," Stoker grumbled. "Now, steel yourself, I am going to pull you up."
He was flat upon his belly in that grotesque place, covered from head to toe in filth. But he was the most beautiful sight I had ever seen. He hauled me to safety like so much cargo, shifting me about with more regard for speed than comfort. But when I arose over the lip of the tunnel, I heard his muttered thanks to a deity in which he did not believe. I saw, too, the leg he had locked through the iron staple on the wall to anchor him as he dove for me, and I knew he would be bruised to the bone. I said nothing of my own hurts, merely gave him a determined smile and plucked a dead rat from my bedraggled hair. I pointed to the tunnel, looming just overhead. "He must have made his escape there. Let us follow." Just then the moonlight from the grill above shifted. There was a scraping noise, and the glow of a lantern being thrust into the narrow shaft.
"I say, what the devil are you doing down there?"
an autocratic voice demanded.
"Come out at once!"
Our eyes dazzled by the sudden light, we peered up into the face of Sir Hugo Montgomery. Chapter 17. Sir Hugo put his hand out to assist me, but suddenly reeled back, either at the sight or the smell. It was impossible to say which was the more off-putting.
"I suppose it's too much to ask why the pair of you were galloping about the sewers," he said politely.
"We were in pursuit of the miscreant masquerading as Anubis," I told him loftily, "which is more than you can say for any of your lot." He applied a handkerchief to his nose, perhaps as much in defense against our odoriferousness as his ailment. "You ought not to be out in this chill when you are still suffering from a cold," I told him, as I was wrapped in a blanket by a nameless Bobby.
"I am recovered,"
Sir Hugo said, stepping sharply backwards.
"Might I suggest a change of clothing, Miss Speedwell? And do not attempt to launder the garments you are wearing. Burn them."
I pulled a face, but obligingly stepped some distance away. "How did you find us?" I called. He pointed behind him, and to my astonishment I saw the looming facade of Karnak Hall.
"You mean the bloody villain led us in a circle?" I cried.
All that filthy water, the stench that sat in my nostrils, and it had all been for nothing. Sir Hugo smiled kindly.
"My men discovered the cover was ajar only after the fellow made use of this means of escape. He left his Anubis mask behind, but there are no clues to be found there. He seems to have led you on a merry chase," he added. "And thanks to your interference," Inspector Archibond said as he approached, "the villain has escaped justice."
"Really?"
Stoker asked.
"I would argue that we were the only ones in pursuit, and we very nearly captured him."
Archibond whirled on him.
"I have a good mind to charge you with interfering in police business."
"There will be no charges,"
Sir Hugo said quietly. Archibond glowered as much as he dared at his superior.
"Sir, I really must insist."
Sir Hugo's aristocratic brows lifted, and Archibond, realizing his lèse majesté, hastened to make amends.
"That is to say, I strongly believe charges are in order."
"A policeman is not interested in beliefs, Archibond, only facts. And the fact is that this matter is now Mornaday's purview."
Archibond's mouth went slack.
"Mornaday? Really, sir, with such a high-profile case, it seems highly irregular to put such an unreliable, unorthodox detective in charge."
"Taking my name in vain, sir?"
Mornaday sauntered up, wearing an air of barely suppressed jubilation, hands thrust into his pockets. Archibond turned on him with a feral growl.
"Take your hands out of your pockets! I told you to leave this investigation alone,"
he began.
"Yes, you did, sir. And I ignored orders for which I am prepared to be reprimanded. But since His Royal Highness found the whole incident jolly entertaining and asked for me personally, I doubt too much will find its way into my official record," he said, his merry brown eyes twinkling.
Archibond, at a loss for words, stalked away, muttering under his breath. I scarcely noticed when he left. Stoker put a quiet hand to my shoulder, intuiting my thoughts. Sir Hugo gave us a long, meaningful look.
"Go back to Bishop's Folly and change. You would not like to be seen in your present condition, I am certain."
He inclined his head the barest inch, and I saw him then, standing just outside his carriage, surrounded by a knot of people. The carriage was marked with his badge, the trio of white plumes, the ostrich feathers that were the unique emblem of the Prince of Wales. He was not a tall man, my father. I judged him some 5 feet 8 inches or thereabouts. His features were unremarkable, although I could see from his smile and the brightness of his eyes that he must have had great charm. Without knowing him for a prince,
One might have made the mistake of thinking him a prosperous man of business. But he was a prince, and that made all the difference. The unmistakable glamour of royalty drew one's attention, as a sun will draw planets into its orbit. He did not look my way. I pulled the blanket, sodden with sewer water, more tightly about me. Sir Hugo tactfully turned away and began issuing orders. "I think we have all made an enemy in Inspector Archibond," I observed, turning deliberately to Mornaday.
"None more than me,"
Mornaday said cheerfully. Stoker, as wet and filthy as I, moved aside to accept a blanket offered by one of the policemen. I took the opportunity to speak quietly to Mornaday. "Does Sir Hugo know that you were the source for J.J. Butterworth's exclusive information?" He flushed deeply to the roots of his hair.
"I think he suspects. How did you know?"
I shrugged. Caroline Templeton Vane left society after her divorce. Few people knew she married John de Morgan, and those who did would not have made the connection between him and Stoker. There were only a handful of people who might have shared that information with Miss Butterworth, and once I met her, I realized you were the likeliest. You have always had a keen appreciation for attractive young women, I added meaningfully. He flushed again.
"It is not like that," he insisted. "Archibond has been trying to push his way to the top ever since he arrived. He's the Home Secretary's godson. With Sir Hugo ill, it was his best chance to shove me out of the way and undercut Sir Hugo's authority. He thought if he could solve the case, it would pave the way for him to be made head of Special Branch. I could not let that happen. I used Miss Butterworth to keep stirring the pot, hoping her stories would shake loose some vital clue. I hoped someone would get nervous enough to trip up and I would be there when it happened. But with Archibond keeping me occupied with mundane work, I couldn't be on hand. Miss Butterworth suggested that she make herself useful as a sort of reconnaissance agent, keeping an eye upon all the principals in the case.
And in return, you fed her information about Stoker, tethering him to the post like a scapegoat, I accused. He held up his hands.
I know I ought to be sorry for that, but you cannot blame me. The fellow monopolizes the only woman I truly care about.
He gave me an intent stare, and I smiled in spite of myself. Mornaday, you are a liar and an opportunist, but you have done your best for Sir Hugo, and I am inclined to believe that it is better to dance with the devil you know.
In that case, I will tell you something for free, he said, jerking his chin in the direction of the hall. Sir Leicester Tiverton has suffered an apoplexy.
I turned just in time to see Sir Leicester borne out of the hall upon a stretcher, insensible, his colour high. Lady Tiverton was at his side, clutching his hand, and Patrick Fairbrother hurried after, his expression grim.
Stoker, I said, calling his attention to the little drama playing out before us.
I am not surprised. The whole affair must have been a dreadful shock, he remarked.
Just then, Horace Steele emerged from the hall, followed hard upon his heels by Henry. Both looked subdued, and they made no movement to follow the Tibetans, going directly to their own carriage and departing with all speed. Last of all came Figgy, following slowly, nearly forgot in all the commotion, staring after her stricken parent with an inscrutable expression. At the last moment, Lady Tiverton turned back, beckoning to her in the crowd and guiding the girl into their conveyance. Stoker touched my shoulder.
I think we ought to go. Sir Hugo has arranged transportation for us.
He gestured the long way around, a path that would take us behind the prince's carriage and keep us to the shadows. I do not think so.
I told him. I clasped the blanket around me as if it were a court robe, and lifted my head. "Pardon me," I said to the nearest courtier. "Make way, if you please. I am passing." Seeing my bedraggled appearance, the little crowd parted, murmuring and tittering. I looked neither right nor left, but as I crossed the pavement, I felt my father's gaze resting upon me. We did not speak. We did not even lock eyes. But I forced him to notice me. It was enough for the moment. At Sir Hugo's insistence, we were driven home, but even his generosity would not extend to the use of his carriage in our present condition. We were given the use of the Black Maria, being carried away like common criminals. But it was quick, and we were soon deposited at Bishop's Folly. In all the confusion, no one noticed the missing diadem, at least none of the Tivertons. Stoker, however, was rather more attentive to detail. He looked once at my bare head and muttered a curse under his breath. "I know," I murmured in reply. "But if it is any consolation, I blame you entirely. This was your idea."
"Of all the bloody—"
I interrupted him then to relate what I had learnt about Mornaday and the identity of our mysterious pursuer. His response, to my astonishment, was a hearty laugh. "You think it amusing that we overlooked so obvious a possibility as J.J. Butterworth being our enigmatic female?" I challenged, as we alighted and made our way to the Belvedere. A nightcap seemed in order.
"I think it amusing that she was bold enough to come to the Tivertons' reception without a personal invitation. What does she look like in a skirt?"
he asked in a thoughtful voice. "Tall, as you might well remember. Hair with an unfortunate ginger tendency. Horns, pitchfork, pointed tail, just as one might expect."
"You did not warm to our new acquaintance?"
"I find her despicable."
"Curious. I should have thought you would feel an affinity to a sister trying to make it in the world on her own,"
he teased. "She is no sister of mine." I had taken up the bottle of aguardiente to pour a nightcap, but I hesitated, my hand wrapped around its neck. "I should very much like a drink," I told Stoker. "But if I spend another second in proximity to you, I believe I shall asphyxiate." I retired that night in a sullen mood. It took 3 plunges in the heated pool and an entire cake of soap before I felt clean again. We had not captured Anubis in the act. We had found nothing suspicious in Lady Tiverton's actions, and I had lost the Unkeset diadem, a fact I was reluctant to share with the Tivertons, particularly now that Sir Leicester had apparently suffered an apoplexy.
"Cheer up," Stoker told me grimly. "Perhaps he will die and you won't have to confess it."
I had shut the door on him then, hard enough to rattle the hinges. I am usually an excellent sleeper. My ability to take my rest, no matter how insalubrious the circumstances, along with a sound stomach and excellent legs, accounts for the success of my travels through varied and demanding parts of the world. I slept little that night. Something evaded me, some fact I could not grasp. It danced out of reach, as insubstantial as a will-o'-the-wisp, and the harder I chased, the more elusive it proved. It was not until morning dawned that I realized what it was. I had, as was my custom, taken up a book to read when I found sleep elusive. It happened that one of Lady Tiverton's volumes was near at hand, and I flipped the pages idly, moving from her lavish descriptions of expedition life to the little pen-and-ink drawings she had included. One in particular caught my attention, and I sat bolt upright in bed, staring at the slender black lines. It was not until I was certain that I rose and washed, dressing with my usual attention to neatness, before running Stoker to ground in the Belvedere. He was stripping rotting sawdust from the inside of his decaying white rhinoceros mount when I found him. His head was stuck deep inside the cavity, and I knocked on the side of the animal to get his attention. "Horace Steele stole the diadem," I announced without preamble.
"I know."
His voice echoed from within the beast. "How the devil did you know?" I demanded.
"I realized it after I retired last night. The thing that I had noticed when the lights went out. There was a sudden waft of bay rum. That was when Steele put out his hand to snatch the diadem."
I thumped the rhinoceros hide with a fist and went to my desk. "Braggart," I muttered, as I flicked through the morning's correspondence. I worked until Stoker saw fit to emerge, shaking the mouldering sawdust from his hair.
"It does not matter," he told me.
He threw one leg casually over the camel saddle, perching atop the leather contraption like a lord of creation.
"You cannot accuse an American millionaire of theft without proof."
"But if he has the diadem in his possession..." He held up a filthy hand, the palms streaked with glue and paint and God only knew what else.
"Veronica, if you had caught him red-handed, we might have made something of it. And even then it would have been a Sisyphean task. Without that, we have nothing."
"We have an obligation to recover the diadem. We were in possession of it when it went missing," I argued. "Besides which, I know something you most assuredly do not. I know the identity of Anubis." I showed him the drawing done by the first Lady Tiverton, and he grinned in spite of himself.
"Of all the devilish..."
"Exactly. Now you know why I believe, with the proper pressure, we can bring Horace Steele to reveal all."
"You really mean to take on a man of Horace Steele's stature and influence? Do you know what sort of trouble you're courting?"
"Courting?" I gave him a scornful look. "I married it long ago. Come now, Stoker. As our favourite detective, Arcadia Brown, would say to her faithful Garvin, Excelsior!" Unfortunately, Lord Rosmoren arrived before we could depart. He appeared in the Belvedere, waving a bit of metal overhead and exciting the dogs until we could hardly hear ourselves think over the bedlam. "How nice to see you, my lord," I shouted. "Have you come to inspect the progress on the collection? I've got a rather nice set of nymphalidae that have just arrived this week from the estate of the Duke of Shrewsbury." He gave me a vague smile.
"Always happy to see your pretty little winged things, Miss Speedwell, but today we are about flight. Stoker, I have just received the last part of the Aerostat Réveillon. Come and see. We must fit it at once."
He bustled out again, and Stoker flicked me an apologetic smile. There was no remedy. Whoever holds the purse strings pulls the puppet strings, I reflected grimly. While Stoker spent the better part of the day engaged in tinkering with the mechanisms of the balloon, I applied myself to the nymphalidae. Ordinarily, the sight of their gorgeous, jewel-bright wings would have enthralled me, and the differences between imagos would have provided me with hours of delighted study. But not this day. Instead, I fretted away every minute, cursing the seconds that ticked past as events unfolded without us. I sent to the Sudbury for word of Sir Leicester's condition and satisfied myself that he was in no imminent danger. At length, just after tea time, the ripe curve of the balloon began to fill, and Stoker appeared, streaked with glue and other assorted substances, which he made a hasty attempt to repair before we set off for the Allerdale Hotel. I dressed carefully for our visit to Horace Steele, donning my working costume. It was an ensemble of my own design, and I was rather proud of it. A pair of slim, dark trousers and a shirt waist formed the base of it. Atop that, I buttoned a jacket fitted with half a dozen pockets of various sizes, and a long skirt whose clever arrangement of buttons permitted me to wear it modestly, all looped up out of the way. Flat boots which laced to the knee, and a broad, flat-brimmed hat fastened with sharpened pins completed the ensemble. I tucked a knife into my boot for good measure, which Stoker found distinctly unnecessary. We argued all the way to the Allerdale Hotel.
"We are not going there for a fight," he reminded me. "We have only a theory that Horace Steele is involved, but no proof."
"Then we will get it."
"And you think bearding him in his den is the way to get it?"
I slanted him a smile. "Never underestimate the element of surprise." At the Allerdale, Horace Steele opened the door himself with an anxious look.
"How is Lester? He's not..."
He broke off, his mouth working furiously. "We have not come from Sir Leicester, but the last we heard he is resting comfortably," I assured him. Something stiff in his manner eased.
"Well, I do not wish him well, but neither do I wish ill luck upon him,"
he said.
"Come in."
We entered the sitting room of his suite to find Henry Steele pacing before the hearth and Figgy Tiverton huddled in a chair. "Miss Tiverton, this is an unexpected pleasure," I said, a trifle acidly. "We know that you fashioned the Mask of Anubis." To my astonishment, she burst into tears, weeping incomprehensibly into her sleeve. Stoker took out one of his enormous red handkerchiefs, but before he could offer it, Henry took out his own, a sturdy piece of plain cambric marked with his monogram in solid block letters. Figgy took it and squeezed his hand gratefully. Horace gave us a speaking look.
"I am afraid you have just arrived in the midst of a confession of sorts, but damn me if I can make any sense of it. Pardon my language, Miss Speedwell,"
he said hastily. "I think we can help with that," I told him. We settled ourselves, and I began to speak. "Figgy, you needn't talk, nor you, Mr. Steele," I said to Henry. "Mr. Templeton Vane and I have worked out most of it. You, Mr. Steele, played the part of Anubis, stripping to the waist and donning the kilt of the ancient Egyptian, a costume supplied, no doubt, by your own extensive travels in that country." He opened his mouth to protest, but I produced the drawing done by the First Lady Tiverton. "A winsome little sketch, don't you think?" I asked gently. "Miss Iphigenia Tiverton and her childhood companion, Henry Steele, playing at one of their favourite games, Egyptian gods. Figgy is dressed as Isis, and you, Mr. Steele, are dressed as Anubis. Lady Tiverton wrote at length about your pastimes, your inseparable friendship, how you were always together, forever covering for one another when your occasional peccadilloes came home to roost. I found it curious that her account did not tally with what either of you told me about your relationship. You both indicated you had not been in contact for some time. Now, that, in itself, is not suspicious. Childhood friends often fall out of touch. But why lie about any present connection unless you were up to something you did not want anyone to guess? It doesn't take a great deal of imagination to suppose that on the strength of your long friendship, Miss Tiverton was able to persuade you to don a similar costume once more." He looked to Figgy, holding her glance with his own. He reached out a fingertip, and she lifted hers to touch it.
"We swore an oath as children," he said in a dull voice. "We cut open our fingers and held them together so the blood would mix. That made us belong to each other. For life, we said.
Whenever one of us needed the other, no matter how long it had been, no matter the situation, we would be there.
His expression was slightly abashed, as if he were ashamed to be caught out as having played such childish games. But his father regarded him with warmth.
"That's a mighty loyal thing, son,"
he said, his lip